Today is July 13th, 2016. My name is Rob Mason. I'm the Student Project Coordinator for the Allard Law History Project. Joining me today is Jeffrey Cowper, a graduate of the class of 1980, currently Senior Counsel and Leader of Fasken Martineau's Litigation and Dispute Resolution Group. He's been counsel in the Supreme Court of Canada in cases involving constitutionality of legislation, charter rights, commercial, tort, and administrative law issues. Welcome, Mr. Cowper.
Thank you.
So I want to begin by asking, given your impressive resume, what do you feel are your biggest accomplishments so far?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think the things I've enjoyed the most are the public law and cutting law questions that I've been able to be involved in, and I don't have any particular hit parade, but on the charter side, I was actually counsel in the first charter case filed and argued on the first day in which the charter came into force in the spring of 1982. I asserted the right to a trial by jury under Section 11F on behalf of a corporate accused under a Combines Act prosecution for bid rigging, which was then appealed unsuccessfully throughout the entire legal system of Canada. We actually were slotted to argue it as the first charter case in the Supreme Court of Canada in the fall of the next year, having failed in the Supreme Court and having failed in the Court of Appeal with one dissent. But we unfortunately succeeded in obtaining a dismissal of the charges against our client in the summer, and so that appeal was never heard. And so it's lost to history. But I also argued the first equality case under the equality provisions of the Charter, which of course didn't come into force for another 3 years, and the case which is known as the Andrews case against the Law Society of BC. So the Charter stuff was very interesting. I've done a number of other Charter cases as well. I argued many years later the Otten decision about the scope of Section 15, and so arguing two of the major Section 15 cases certainly is among the most enjoyable and challenging things I did. I was involved in the Meech Lake constitutional challenges, and that was an interesting challenge because it really concerned the assertion of a constitutional convention as a barrier to constitutional amendment. And I clerked after leaving law school and was very involved in the patriation appeals as a clerk in Ottawa. Which were in part the same conceptual effort on the part of the provinces to assert constitutional convention as an impediment to constitutional amendment. So on the constitutional side, that would be it. I have had the pleasure of arguing a number of private law issues in which the law has been changed, and I don't know if your listeners are interested in that as much as the charter issues. I've been just as interested in those. I've done many appeals on behalf of personal injury plaintiffs who've lost their trials or have succeeded beyond any reasonable expectation in their appeals, and I find that work both challenging and rewarding and a bit frightening because of the importance and the stake in the lives of individual people. And I've done international law since I left, and so the international cases I've been involved in. I was lucky enough to be involved in the first NAFTA case filed and the first NAFTA award in both the low one and the middle clad case, and have from time to time been involved in investor state cases. Other than that, I suppose the things I would find most interesting are the roles I've had as counsel in the various commissions I've been involved in. So I've been involved in the Hall Commission in the 1980s on Indian Affairs policy, and I've been involved in the Matkin Commission. I was counsel of the Matkin Commission on Securities Regulation in the mid-1990s. I was counsel to the Frank Paul Commission on prosecutorial and investigative policy concerning the death of Frank Paul on the downtown east side. Right. And I most recently was asked to address the government on a report on the administration of criminal law, which is called Criminal Justice for the 21st Century. And so those would be also highlights.
So you mentioned
stop
that.
Stop there.
Okay, great. We can elaborate further as we go on, obviously. But you mentioned that some of your work is challenging, rewarding, and a bit frightening, I think you said. Could you elaborate on what motivates you to do the work that you do?
Well, I think two things. I'm attracted by service, and so I find the most rewarding thing being of service either to the public interest or to individuals. The challenge and rewarding part of being of service to the public has less direct human consequences than being of service to individuals. So if you're acting for a plaintiff who's lost a trial and is permanently disabled, as an example, and you're trying to get them a new trial, I find that challenging and a bit frightening, because if you fail, which I have failed, you have somebody who's severely, permanently injured, who has no compensation, and so their lives are acutely affected by your professional work.
Let's rewind a little bit and start talking about your background. Could you tell me a bit about where you grew up?
I don't really have a background. I did grow up, though. So I was born in southern Alberta. My mother was from a Norwegian French-Canadian farming family, a small town in rural Alberta. My father was an Anglo-Indian from a town called Pune in India, and he had come to Canada in the war to receive air flight training for the RAF, and then in the late 40s returned to Canada since India was going through partition and was in a fairly unattractive location for a young Anglo-Indian man. And so he returned to Canada, and that's where I was born and brought up. So I was born and brought up in various parts of southern Alberta, subject to traveling with my family to other parts of the world, including the Caribbean and the Middle East, because my father became involved in the oil and gas industry, and so that's a bit of a peripatetic existence.
What did you do before law school?
Yeah, I think I'm a person without any relevant background on that. I came to UBC to study genetics. Mm-hmm. I was interested in avian genetics. I wanted to do a PhD in avian genetics, and UBC in the 1970s was a burgeoning department in relation to genetics. David Suzuki at that point was actually an academic geneticist. Mm-hmm. He hadn't yet started his more public career.
Right.
And Smith, who later received the Nobel Prize for the work he was doing in the 1970s, was actively involved in genetics. So I was very attracted to that. I came here. For one reason or another, was persuaded that there was no future in genetics, which was very bad advice, and that there was a future in law, and I had been involved in my school career in debating and model parliament, and so it was a natural second alternative to me. So I switched in my undergraduate from emphasizing science only to more arts-oriented background, and I came into law school after my third year, although I barely made it into law school. That's another story.
Was it this practical concern then that genetics was less fulfilling of a career or less? What sort of motivated that switch? Could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, no, I think it was a couple of things. I had fallen in love with a young woman and thought I might need to earn a living. And I was also, and have always been, attracted to the process of debate and people's stories. And so I think I was attracted to the law, and I fell in love with it from the first day of law school. So it wasn't a reluctant choice on my part. But I've always had a passion and interest in science, which I've retained and still retain. And it's probably my first love, but they're not entirely in different families.
Right. So did you feel that your background prepared you for law school and science?
Well, I had I had less of a background than most people have. I think the preparation I had was probably an interested mind. I was very young. I was, I think, the second youngest student in our class. I was 20 when I started first year law school. I think there was a woman who was 19 from Singapore. So I think I was, as I said, I had less background than most people.
Right.
I had been a voracious reader since for school. And I grew up in a bookish kind of household, and I grew up in a household in which a large family in which nobody agreed with anybody else on any item of interest. And so it was a disputatious family background, which is the best preparation for law school, or certainly the best preparation for litigation.
What sort of courses interested you most as a law student?
Well, I should tell you how I came to law school and UBC, because I barely started law school and certainly barely came here. Okay. So I determined to apply in third year, and I had largely decided that I wouldn't finish my degree. I thought of doing graduate work in arts, mm-hmm. and had an offer to actually do graduate work abroad, but I decided that I would apply to law school. And so the only law school I could apply to, I'd missed the deadline for every other law school in Canada, and the only law school I could apply to was UBC, because mm-hmm. it was an inter-faculty application. You only had to prepare one piece of paper and do the LSAT. And so I filed that, and I didn't receive any response from the dean's office. And time went on, and the summer arrived, and I still hadn't received a response. And I phoned the dean's office, and they had said, well, no, you've been rejected, because all of the offers have been issued. Mm-hmm. And although there's a backup list, you've been rejected, and you'll get the rejection soon. And a month or two passed, and I didn't get my rejection. And I guess being stubborn, I phoned them back up and said, you know, I don't want to make an issue of this, but I never got the rejection.
Right.
And I had very good marks, and I had a very good LSAT, and so my friends had told me I would get admitted. So it was a bit of a puzzle, and I asked them, I said, you know, I did have what seemed to be good enough marks and right. high enough LSAT, which were the two factors in those days. And she said, well, look, I'm sorry I keep answering you, but you've been rejected, and so stop bothering us. And on the Friday before classes started, I had signed up for all my other courses and was going to finish my undergraduate degree. And out of nothing other than a curiosity, I phoned her up and said, just to let you know, I don't know what about your office procedures, but I've had the same address. I've never received your rejection letter.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, essentially, the class is filled. I don't know what happened to your rejection letter, but you were rejected in February or March, and so I don't know why you keep calling me. So about an hour later, I got a call from Dean Lissick, and he said, I'm Mr. Cowper, and that's how he spoke. Mr. Cowper, I'm very sorry, but the admissions dean has come to me, and it's come to our attention that your application fell between the desk of the admissions clerk and the wall, and it has sat unread for the last 7 months or 6 months.
Wow.
And so I apologized, and I said, well, that's, you know, mistakes happen, but would I have been admitted? And he said, well, yeah, I'm sorry to say, but you would have been in the first group of admissions had we known of your application. I said, well, does that mean that that's the end of the conversation? He said, yes, I'm afraid it is, because in view of the mistake that we made, I went back and looked at the state of the class, and we went back and reconfirmed the last acceptances, mm-hmm. and the class of 250 is full, and there's a waiting list of 96 people, and so I'm afraid that you'll just have to do something else.
Mm.
And I said, well, that's unfortunate, but I understand people make mistakes. And he said, what I am prepared to do, and this is now Friday at 4 o'clock, what I am prepared to do in light of our mistake is to put you first on the waiting list,
because
okay. you would have been accepted earlier.
Right.
He says, unfortunately, though, as I say, we've gone through and everybody's confirmed, so the only thing that will happen is if someone on the weekend changes their mind, we'll call you on Tuesday morning. And so at Tuesday at 9 o'clock, I got a call that precisely one person had withdrawn on the weekend, and that they had a slot for me, and if I could be there by 9:30, I could get into law school.
Wow.
So that's how I got into law school.
Wow. Would you have applied again the next year, do you think?
I don't think I would have, actually. I think yeah. I would have probably applied to another school elsewhere.
Hmm. So then, going back to my other question, what courses interested you most as a student?
You know, I was one of those irritating, extremely enthusiastic students. And so my list of favorites was pretty much all of my courses. In fact, in law school, we had lockers. And in the course of first year, Doonesbury cartoons had a series on Harvard Law, mm-hmm. and there was a comic figure in the Doonesbury cartoons of a person who would sit in the front and insist on answering all the questions and always had his hand up and was a very irritating, eager student. And someone in my class photocopied that and taped it to my locker. And then when I took it off, they taped it again. And so I more or less had that cartoon taped, various episodes of that cartoon taped on my locker. So I think I liked everything that I did in law school. I found that law school was immediately enormously attractive to me at every level.
Did you participate in anything outside of your courses while in law school? Like LSLAB?
I did. I did a variety of things. I actually... I did some research for some professors. I did the Jessup Moot, which mm-hmm. was very demanding in second year, and I did research between my third year and clerking. I received a clerkship at the very end of my third year, unexpectedly, and so I did legal research that summer, although mm-hmm. I had a child on June 2nd, and so we had a lot going on that summer.
Wow, yeah. Where did you clerk?
I clerked in the Supreme Court of Canada for Mr. Justice Martland from 1980 to 1981.
Okay. And now you mentioned that you did a lot of charter work in the 80s, I guess, starting out. But you went to law school from 77 to 80, right? So
yes.
I'm curious what, if you felt that you were prepared to take on charter issues before that was taught, or if everyone was in the same boat. Like, what was it like to practice in that area right at the beginning?
Well, I think maybe I should tell you a little bit of a law school story around getting the clerkship, because I believe I was only the second clerk from British Columbia in the previous 10 years. Hmm. Funnily enough, there were two of us that year because University of Victoria had a graduating class. It was either the first or the second graduating class.
Okay.
And Justice McIntyre, who was originally from British Columbia, appointed Joel Friley, who's had a long career in constitutional law at the Ministry of the Attorney General in Victoria, as his clerk. So after, I think, at least a 10-year drought, two of us from BC were clerking that year, and that was pretty much the last year in which there were only 9 clerks, and then the number of clerks per judge expanded to its present magnificent sum. And so it was a very interesting transitional period. So in terms of constitutional law, I was very interested in constitutional law in law school just because of the subject matter. I had no expectation that I would ever practice in constitutional law or do anything. I think one of the themes of my legal education was that I took everything very seriously that people said I would never be able to use in practice, and then ended up finding that I used all of it in practice. So I was very interested in estate litigation. There was virtually no estate litigation, I thought, in the practice, and I ended up doing a bunch of it. I was very interested in constitutional law and took an advanced constitutional law seminar and did a dedicated paper on history of constitutional law in my third year, and without any expectation it would be interesting. I didn't expect to be clerking, but when I clerked, I actually, the year of 80-81 was the year not only of the patriation cases, but we had some 20 constitutional cases. So I spent a very large portion of my year as a clerk working in constitutional law, most of them division of powers cases.
Yeah.
There was no charter yet, but that was the year in which the charter was being mooted and debated and settled upon and then ultimately litigated in respect to the patriation cases. So it was being present at the creation, so to speak, and in fact the people who I clerked with, for the most part, became constitutional experts. So Neil Finkelstein from McGill University, who's ended up authoring constitutional textbooks and appearing in many constitutional cases, was a clerk for the Chief Justice, and Pat Monahan, who's now the Deputy Attorney General, but a long-serving constitutional scholar, was another clerk. And similarly, there are others who are both in French Canada and English Canada, ended up being prominent constitutional scholars or counsel.
What would you say is your most memorable moment of law school? something in particular stand out?
Well, I, as I think I've said, I probably was the most irritating law student for my classmates, but so I have a few memorable moments. I'm not sure they paint me in a totally good light. One I always remember is my very first question that I answered in law school, mm-hmm. and Leon Goetz taught the general introduction to ethics and law, legal thinking, to first year at that time, and was a superb professor. And the very first question in the very first minute was he put on the blackboard that the law progresses from molar to molecular. And did anybody know what that meant? And I, in the spirit of what I said earlier, immediately put up my hand, and he said, what does that mean? And I said, well, a molar, M-O-L-A-R, is a chemical description of gas at room temperature, and it's 6.02 times 10 to the 28th molecules, and molecules are, of course, just one point of that. So I assume this means that law progresses in either leaps and bounds or very, very slowly. And there was a chill over the class. Nobody laughed because I think everybody else was afraid to answer the question. And Leon Goetz was completely taken aback. I think it's fair to say that no one else had ever answered the question in that way.
Right.
And he was completely flummoxed and said, actually, I don't know what a molar means in chemistry, but this is a reference to moles below the ground. And so I turned a fairly deep shade of red, but it didn't deter me from answering questions for the next 3 years, probably more than my share.
So after you finished clerking, what did you pursue then?
I have to say, by the way, that in the ensuing years, I have been convinced that my answer was correct.
It sounds like a good answer. So after you finished clerking, what was next for you?
So I originally planned on going to Alberta to practice, where my home province, and mm-hmm. I actually summered in it was unusual in those days to summer at all, but there was one firm in Calgary that had summer students, and I was able to secure a position, and my wife and I, who I was married in law school, lived in Calgary and enjoyed it enormously, mm-hmm. and she had been born and brought up in Vancouver, and her grandfather, she loved dearly, had arranged to leave her a very small cabin on the coast of the northern coast of Bowen Island. Mm. And at the end of the summer, she said, look, we're probably going to spend the rest of our life in Alberta, but I'd really love to live for the first couple of years of our marriage in my grandfather's cabin. Mm. And so I agreed to do that. And so in 1980, when we graduated, my wife had become pregnant, as I mentioned earlier, and our first son was born on June 2nd. Shortly after graduating, and we moved to Bowen Island, and we've been temporarily there since then. Subject to, you know, we've been away for clerking and other times, but that's what I did. So I articled with Russell and Dumoulin, as it then was, after returning from clerkship. I had secured an articling position in Vancouver once we had decided to move to Vancouver at Russell and Dumoulin.
Right.
And I think I was one of their sort of afterthoughts of articling students because I hadn't secured a clerkship at that point, so I was one of many, I'm sure, equally deserving students, or one of the lesser equally deserving students. And then I came back from clerking and articled with them, and I've been with the firm in its various iterations since then.
Right.
It's a fairly boring employment path.
Do you remember what the interview process was like?
For clerking, for articling? Well, again, I probably was fortunate because I, as I said, had decided to go to Alberta. Mm-hmm. And so I actually did not apply for articles in British Columbia. And because I decided to go to Alberta, I had not spoken to any of my classmates about the process of articles. I had no lawyers in my family. I had no coaching.
Right.
So I did not know the whole procedure. And so when we decided to come to Vancouver, I only applied to a few firms. And in those days, you would apply to 30 firms, and there was a veritable storm of interviews and you had to apply to 30 firms because they interviewed pretty much everybody, and there was a high attrition rate between those people, and I suspect I wasn't a very attractive candidate. So in any event, I only had a few firms, and I actually only had one articling offer. And the articling offer was actually, I was rejected by all the firms, including the firm I articled with, including Russell and Dumont, said that they had many more deserving other alternatives. Hmm. And so I was considering my future, and I was thinking of going back to Alberta. I was sort of unemployed and married, and then going back at the very end of the articling week, as it then was, I got a call from Russell and Dumont saying that one of the more deserving candidates had turned down their position.
Okay.
And so I was next on the list of also-rans to offer the job to. And I said to him, so do you want me to come down for a second interview? Because they never phoned me for second interviews, which were more or less standard at the time if you're actually going to get a job. And he said, more or less, I don't think you understand. You're basically being offered a job that we have to fill. We don't really care who's there. If you want it, you can have it. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I'll offer it to other people. So I said yes, and so I ended up having a job. There were no other people fighting to get my services.
And that's the second time you're number one on the wait list, right?
Yes, yeah. No, it's a theme. It's yeah. a theme in my life.
Hmm. What would you say is the best aspect of your current job?
Well, I'm spoiled, and I hope it continues. I am the putative head of our department. Being the head of a litigation department is more illusion than reality, but by reason of the practice that I've enjoyed, I have a very varied practice with public law and private law matters, mm-hmm. and so I have lots of exciting cases, and I work with very, very talented people who are lots of fun and challenge me to do well, and I'm constantly learning and doing a broad variety of things. I think it's hard to do today what I was just able to do. The era of specialization was really taking off when I was a young lawyer, and I was able to dip into enough areas of law that I had credibility to argue them, and so I still argue in a broad variety of areas, and I'm a big fan of specialization, but in my own practice I've managed to retain a general litigation practice. Right. So I enjoy the variety and the challenge of being involved in cutting edge cases and issues, and so I think that's probably, I've, as I say, been spoiled and would like to remain so.
And conversely, what's the most difficult aspect of your job?
Well, I think it's very simple. The most difficult aspect of my job is juggling all of the various demands on my time, professional and personal, and I have a very active life outside of the law. I try to contribute to the community in a variety of ways, so I'm on a number of boards and other efforts, and so just managing the logistics of my life. I think this is our fourth or fifth appointment, and so people want to see me, and so that's probably the most difficult
sure.
part of my life.
Yeah. And what are some of the personal things you enjoy doing? What do you do in your free time?
Well, it's an interesting question. So mostly my free time is involved with other organizations. I don't have many conventional holidays. I'm a very active, physically active person. I live on the water. I kayak almost every day. I'm at home to get some exercise. My wife is a very vigorous mountaineer and hiker, and so I try to keep up with her, failing to do so, but I try to occupy the same mountain paths from time to time. I'm an enthusiastic but episodic cross-country skier. And I read a lot in a broad variety of science and other areas. Mm-hmm. But most of my life outside of the law, I'm engaged in international conservation, very actively involved in a number of conservation projects around the world. Mm-hmm. I'm very involved in a number of law reform projects, and I'm involved in a variety of charities and foundations which are involved in areas such as homelessness. I've been very actively involved in the effort to reduce homelessness in Vancouver for the last 9 years. I was one of the founding directors of Street to Home Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I'm a director of a facility for mentally ill homeless people in East Vancouver. and I'm involved in charities in relation to healthcare and Christian work, because I have a faith commitment, and I'm very involved in my church, and very involved in various efforts to contribute to human welfare through Christian work.
So in terms of your career and your future, what's still on your to-do list? What do you hope to achieve?
Well, I'm hoping it's more of the same. I have a long list of projects I'd like to accomplish. I think in terms of law, the most distinctive challenge ahead of me, which is an interesting one, is to try to contribute to the ongoing debate about the efficient administration of justice in Canada and in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. This morning I had an interview with the CBC on my report to the government, which is now 4 years ago, and I made a large number of recommendations there, some of which have come about and some of which have not. I'm trying to think actively of how to keep that reform agenda active and alive and progressive in a way that is contributive and additive to people's interests in British Columbia. I'd like to do some legal writing that I haven't been able to secure the time for. Otherwise, I'd like to move ahead in other respects other than just continuing to do challenging cases, which I think do contribute to human welfare, and working hard to get them decided as best as can be decided.
So I know you're busy. This will be my last question. Do you have any advice you'd like to share for law students or for young lawyers?
Well, I think you have to update yourself for what the new world brings. I think that listening to somebody who started in the 1970s is probably not the first place to start. I think that you need to pay attention, and I think young people do. It's a very different world. So I would say I would enthusiastically embrace specialization. I think the law is too large and complex today to start from a cold start and to have a grasp of all the areas of law. Mm. And I think you have a more rewarding and contributive career, even if you do different specializations in your career, if you tackle and embrace specialization. That's the first thing I would say. I think, you know, the only obvious other one for somebody from my perspective is to do what you love. I mean, we work hard, and if you don't like what you're doing, then you're not going to be as good at it. And I've been lucky to like a lot of different things, and I think you should, if you have a narrower compass of things you do, you should do those things which you love, and you'll be better at it. And I think, for my part, working hard at it allows you to love it in a more deep and rich way, and you'll find the rewards are commensurate with how much effort you put into it.
Anything you'd like to add before we conclude?
I'd like to say that the principal memory I have of law school, which I worry about it being real going forward, is that in the 1970s you had a broad variety of professors who were fantastic teachers, mm-hmm. and who had a broad variety of perspectives. And so I, for example, did my advanced constitutional working paper under Bill Black. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure Bill and I probably ever agreed on a particular issue of constitutional law, but he was an inspiring teacher, a very good role model, and a very willing and available person. Mm-hmm. My corporate law professor was a Marxist from Ireland, and he was here for a year. I've done a lot of corporate litigation, and I actually did some research for him, and I found him to be a disciplined, excellent academic. At the same time, probably my favorite professor of all time were, you know, Bertie McLean and Tony Hickling, who were much more conventional, down the middle of the road scholars of a very, very top quality, and more traditional legal scholars. My fear for the university environment is that scope of debate seems to be narrowing, and that we have only one perspective represented in the academic world. It may be my distance from the academic world, but I worry that the academic world has become a more cramped conversation, and that we need to recapture the sense that an active debate is in all of our interests, and that people need to be respected even when they have profound differences and disagreements.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
You are.